I'm Paul Berners.
And I'm Mike Halverson. We're a student faculty team in the Department of History at Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington. Welcome to Innovative History, a podcast brought to you by the Innovation Studies program at PLU. Innovative History shows history in motion and is driven by academic and technological breakthroughs.
For this episode, we're looking at recent history research projects on video games from Mike's History 499 Senior Seminar this last spring.
We're joined by the following PLU students.
Coley Query.
And Jevin Wilski.
And we're going to discuss their projects about how historians use innovative sources like video games in and out of the classroom.
Our conversation is grounded in game studies, media studies, and the history of video games, and of course, history. After the short break, we're beginning our discussion by introducing ourselves as historians, PLU students, and gamers.
This show is presented by PLU's Innovation Studies program, where students learn fundamental innovation concepts like design thinking, entrepreneurship, and the history of technology. Then they put them together for the public good. To learn more about the Innovation Studies minor and our current projects in the community, visit www.plu.edu/innovation-studies.
Welcome back to Innovative History. And let's begin this episode by introducing ourselves so our listeners get a little bit of an idea of who we all are. As you all know, I'm Fulton. I'm a history and communication major. And to describe my history capstone project in three words from last semester, I would say Call of Duty. You know, that's it. So I'll toss it over to Coley.
So my name is Coley Query. I graduated with degrees in history and Holocaust and genocide studies, but I'm currently in graduate school for education. I would describe my last semester history research project as augmented reality and Pokemon. Oh, I'll toss it over to Jevin.
Hi, I'm Jevin Wilski. I'm currently going into my fourth year at PLU. I am a history and computer science double major. And to describe my project in three words, I would probably say educational video games, to put it simply. And now I'll pass it to Mike.
All right, so I'm Mike Halverson. I was the teacher of all three of these people and a bunch more. In the spring at PLU, we have capstones. And we had a history capstone that encouraged students to write their own research project on a theme that they chose. And we were talking about transportation and technology more generally, but they chose to write about video games and use video games as historical sources. So we thought we'd just hang out together and talk about the experience.
Yeah, totally. As we can all see, we're all historians and we all study video games to some extent. And last season on Innovative History, we focused a lot on video games as sources. And what we really learned is that to learn from video games as a historical source, we have to put them at the center of our analysis, or focusing on their production, their creators, their content, and their context. So the historians in here are using historical skills like that for video games and also all sorts of other fields and applying it to the work across multiple disciplines to better understand the past with innovative technologies.
And we wanted to start this off by asking each of our talented students why they're history majors in the first place, or why the study of history fits into their overall college experience. So I thought we'd start with Jevin. Jevin, why are you a history major?
So it's actually quite fitting for the subject of what we're talking about today. I first got interested in history in high school when I took my first history class, and I started learning about some of the common historical concepts and common historical eras. But I had previously experienced these concepts in Assassin's Creed in middle school. And so seeing these things from video games that I had already had enjoyment and experience from, and then learning about them, was a really cool and like kind of relatable experience, I guess. It made it more real for me. And so then that just kept going throughout my high school career. I got to the end of high school and I was like, I want to do history. And so I came to PLU, started taking history classes, and that enjoyment and that interest has only grown since then.
Yeah, and Jevin, as we've discussed, you know, many students that we run into in classrooms have played that Assassin's Creed series, Crusades, the Renaissance one, all the way up to their more recent games. So you're not alone. I'm super glad you're part of the program. We're going to ask the same question to Coley now. Why are you a history major, Coley?
Right. So I actually share a lot of the same sentiment that Jevin expressed earlier. So I played a lot of the like Sid Meier Civilization. What is that one? The Vault, Rise of Empires? Is that what it's called? Right. Age of Empires, things like that with my family. And then when I got into high school, I became really interested in learning about the things that I had already been playing. Additionally, I didn't actually figure this out until Mike told me last semester in my capstone, but I love learning about communities. And so I think history has and historical thought has a lot to do with learning about how communities and how communities work and who's in communities, who's out of them. And I think that's really applicable to how they're represented in video games as well.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, super interesting. So Fulton, can you answer the same question? Why are you a history major?
Yeah, I think I definitely fit into the same like timeline as both Coley and Jevin. I was really into like Red Dead Redemption growing up and Call of Duty. And then I started playing Civ in middle school. And that was just like a totally new way to look at the past because you can recreate civilizations in new ways, which is kind of weird. And even counterfactual games like Wolfenstein. So I was always interested in the past and how it's been displayed in media. And then in high school, I took AP US History, and that just opened the whole door into like looking at primary sources and seeing what we can learn from about the past, even though we've already studied it so much.
The Department of History at PLU offers compelling coursework, individualized instruction, and innovative student-faculty research opportunities, including special programs in innovation studies and Holocaust and genocide studies. Prepare for your future by studying the past. See www.plu.edu/history for more information.
Okay, so one of the things we've stressed in history is that we need to continue to be creative and innovative in the way that we approach our topics, right? We don't want to tell the same old story, but a new one. So Coley, maybe we can start with you. How did you pick your topic related to video games and technology, and in what way is that innovative or creative for you?
So I struggled a lot when we got the theme of technology and travel because I knew I wanted to do video games, but I wasn't quite sure what direction I was going to go with it. And I started really spitballing with Mike. I was going to initially do arcades and like the arcade movement.
Which I really liked, by the way.
Yeah, I still want to do that. But then I started thinking about augmented reality and, you know, Pokemon Go, the kind of first really big augmented reality game debuted in 2016. So I kind of was like, is this history? Does this count as history? And Mike was like, go for it. And so I wanted to discuss again more about the communal aspect of like what Pokemon Go does socially and how that relates back to video games in the past and maybe like arcade culture and how video games bring people together, which is kind of the basis of my project. I think that kind of leans into a lot of the other video game projects that we did, which talk about communities.
Totally. Jevin, same question for you. You know, how did you pick your project, and in what ways do you feel like that's pushing things forward or being innovative?
Yeah, I'm kind of like the opposite of what Coley said, where you didn't really know at the beginning. I have known that I have wanted to write about this topic since my senior year of high school. This is something that I have been thinking about constantly, and having the opportunity to finally write about just how video games can be used in education, both in a historical sense and a non-historical sense, because it has impacted my life and my school education since I was born and since I started being in education. I have had that video game presence, and so finally being able to share that and talk about my thoughts with the world, or at least with this community of people, has just been wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, as a teacher, sometimes you get students like Jevin who say, it is my destiny to be in this class.
Yeah, literally.
You're like, okay, so what do you feel like you should work on? And others are not sure, right? They have to go through a process. But we'll hear more about your project in a little while and how you want to use video games to teach people about history. Fulton, same question for you. You know, you picked your project. You said it was Call of Duty related. But how did you come upon that, and in what ways does that seem innovative or creative to you?
Well, for me, I really focused on like the landscapes and the environments of Call of Duty and how they tell a story. And, you know, Call of Duty deals with like these big events and facts, and I feel like that's pretty known. So when we can really look into these worlds and see what else we can glean from it instead of just like, oh, here's the date and text that they put on this mission. It's actually see what's in the levels and how the players navigate it. But this brings me to the question of, how did we all use video games in our projects? I can toss it back to Coley.
Right.
Use the video game as a source.
So I already brought up that Pokemon Go came out in 2016, but I actually avoided it at all costs when it came out because I was like, oh, it's so buggy. Like, people are complaining about it. I don't want to get into this mess. But I started playing it in March, right when we started our capstones. And I was like, wow, this is so cool. And just like looking through the app and seeing what it really encourages people to do, because it broadcasts itself as a very social community-based game. And so I was like, is that really something that's true? And then I found myself like suddenly surrounded by like 30 people on campus that play. And so I was like, wow, there's this whole like subsection of campus that's just like totally overwritten by this virtual world. And it was so eye-opening to me because I'm sure that there are other communities like that, like Niantic's other games, Ingress, the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. Those two games like use the same servers. So I'm sure that there's a community that focuses on that too. But I just found it very intriguing that I was just suddenly enmeshed in this like virtual world I didn't know existed. It was really novel. It was amazing.
Your project begins in the coolest way, the final paper, right? Because you wake up on a weekend morning and you go and you're going to go get breakfast, and then you walk out and there are all these people wandering around playing Pokemon Go.
Yeah, it was wild because when I was a freshman in college, which is what Mike is talking about, is I woke up and there was a community day, which is when people can catch a certain number of Pokemon, and it's the same. It's like one Pokemon that's highlighted and you get special bonuses for catching them that day. And the campus was just flooded with people. I'm talking like 100, 200 people walking around at like 9 a.m. on a Sunday morning. And I was so confused because I had no idea what was going on. And now, like, this past weekend, I still play. This past weekend, there was another community day, and I was like, oh no, I missed it. And I ran back on campus, like, to find them. And I was... Yeah, it's a great game. I really found that, like, found a community and really loved it, which is interesting because I really only played it for the research project.
Yeah, the historical insight we're getting here, which is super important, is that communities are often formed through these virtual means. And this sort of contemporary augmented reality way of forming a community seems really modern, but think about how communities were formed around, like, television or radio or the printing press or automobiles or earlier technologies. So by studying, you know, this sort of contemporary cutting edge community formation, our students are able to compare present to past. I think that's pretty important.
Yeah, it's super important, I would say. I saw the same thing kind of in Call of Duty. It wasn't as like contemporary as Coley because the two games I focused on came out in 2006 and 2008, but reading YouTube comments or listening to old interviews and exploring forums about these video games, Call of Duty 2 and Call of Duty World at War really show how communities are formed and how the fan base can drive a series and its creators.
Yeah, you have, Bolton, been talking about the violence in Call of Duty as one of our themes, you know, in this podcast series. But this wasn't as much about the violence as the community and the way the story is told through travel and other mechanisms, right?
Right, Mike. So the travel and mechanisms of Call of Duty, so I like played the games and then watched how people played them online. So when you go into these worlds of Call of Duty 2 and Call of Duty World War, specifically the single player campaigns, the levels are laid out in specific ways by how the developers place like barrels or doors and walls and set up objectives, which can be violent, but also there's small things like this door is just going to be closed. You can't go there, so it's going to force you to go there. Or, in a violent sense, enemies will force you to go other places in the level. So it's a really good mix of like recreating communities from war using photorealism and other artifacts from those places, but also it uses the elements of battle.
For some listeners, if this seems esoteric, just think about a contemporary app like a Strava app that lets you see how a bike ride went virtually, or Google Maps that shows mm-hmm. how a car ride might go. These are sort of virtual systems that allow you to track travel. And Fulton is looking at that within this video game that is quite complex.
Yeah, and Jeff, you kind of explored that a little bit with like the ruins and stuff and how the landscapes of Assassin's Creed show certain events that happened in the past.
Yeah, one of the main Assassin's Creed things that I looked at was the very first Assassin's Creed depicts the city of Acre, like right after it has been invaded by Crusaders. And the developers did a really great job of showing that instead of just simply telling you, hey, this is a thing that happened. Some of the buildings have like structural damage. There are towers that are totally missing the tops of them. And so that goes back to that, like, you can't go here because it's been destroyed, you know, or there will be walls that have fallen over in the middle of a road and you can't go there because, you know, it's been destroyed and it's in the way. You can't get over it, that sort of thing. Just that violence, that damage preventing you from going places.
Yeah, I love that experience of seeing within the game, there must be some past here that we're not seeing. And it brings out the curiosity about, hey, what would the past have been before this crusade happened in Acre?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with this, I think we can kind of set out some of the things that we've learned from video game environments. There's that one piece we read that basically said how to analyze environmental game environments as texts. So there's all these other pieces in history that are analyzing video games, I think, for the environment.
Right. Historians usually use texts to study the past. Some people have said we have text fetishes, right? that we just love. We get super excited when we see these texts, particularly if they're old and dusty. You have to blow the dust off them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all that stuff. But video games really can do some of the same work that text does, because it has an author, an intention, a context, a vocabulary, a set of traits and characteristics. And so as students learn to study video games in sort of these textual ways, I'm using my little quotation marks to everyone, then I think they do pick up some really important skills, which that we then want to transfer into other sources, right? So we want people to read. And of course, these students aren't talking about it, but you all did a lot of reading, actually, in your project.
We did,
right?
a lot of reading.
Coley, can you talk about the reading you did?
You know, I was shocked by the amount of studies that came out about Pokemon Go, even in, like, 2017, so, like, right after it came out. There's a lot of questions about, like, what it means to have an augmented reality, so the idea of what it, like, if we have a physical space, what does it mean to have a virtual overlay on that space, and what does that virtual overlay do? So just for example, there are a lot of texts that talk about how Pokestops, which is the in-game like location-oriented mechanic, how those apply meaning to space and what that means. I mean, if we're talking about like reading virtual landscapes, Pokemon Go overlays over the physical landscape a new virtual landscape, and in that it has things that exist in that one and not in that one. And so a lot of people talk about like how it can assign more importance to some spaces over others. There's also a very large argument about whether or not Pokemon Go is a physical activity, which I didn't really touch on in my my paper, but there is that. And there's a lot, more than I could ever read. It's amazing.
Jevin, talk about the stuff you read.
So because my subject was how we can converse video games and history and education, have them like talking to each other and working with each other, I read a lot of different articles about some articles about literally just how to teach and what some of the best methods are, but some articles about specifically teaching history with video games and looking at the kind of inconsistencies that video games show, not necessarily as a point at something, hey, this is incorrect, this is not how it was, but rather this is something that the developers chose to artistically interpret in this way, and then what that says about the developers and what that says about what evidence we have and what might have actually happened, if that's the history that we want to go for, what actually happened.
I think many of us will be familiar with film studies, right, that went through that process of watching films and critiquing films and the director and the scenes and so on. And video games is going through that same process. So
yeah.
Jevin is talking about this literature that is trying to apply, in some ways, media studies or film studies and other techniques to that. Now, you also are a computer scientist. You're a mm-hmm. programmer. So what insights did you get with your double major here, helping you think about, you know, computers and the way video games are coming as a potential future topic for education?
I think one of my most fun insights is when people who don't know how programming and making video games works try to talk about how programming and video game making works, because I don't want to like throw shade at people, but there are a lot of people that don't, at least a lot of people that I read, that didn't necessarily understand that process and how intense it is and how much effort it takes to do something so very specific, to write out in a program and have it return one specific thing takes a lot of effort. It's not just something that you can do. And so there were authors that I read that were like picking on video games for having this, I don't have an example off the top of my head, but just things that video games did wrong in the eyes of history, when it's like, no, they did that wrong because they can't do that. The technology wasn't there at the time. It's probably not there now, and it won't be there for a while.
Right. People didn't smile like that in the past. Right? That's an artificial, weird, robotic smile.
They didn't dress like that. They didn't move around like this. These people are just walking from place to place with no purpose. Like, a video game can't put all of that in there. That's so much computational power and so much work that a programmer has to do and an animator has to do in order to actually make that stuff happen.
Yeah, it's a 2008 game engine, you know.
Yeah,
that's like, I mean, that also like, does realism matter in terms of
exactly.
making a historical video game? Does it have to be 100% accurate in terms of like dialect? We have it in English. Like,
yeah.
Assassin's
yeah.
Creed is in English,
and then 10 other languages.
And then 10 other
yeah.
languages.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, we've all talked together about earlier video games too, right? Oregon Trail and some of these earlier games that had very minimal special effects, minimal animation. And there could be a lot of historical concepts that can be brought in there. Fulton, we want to give you a chance to talk about the scholarship that you looked at too, because you didn't just sit around and play in Call of Duty, although I know you played a lot.
I did play a lot of Call of Duty. But a lot of the texts I looked at were a combination of both Coley and Jevin's thoughts, but I really dove into the historical first-person shooter genre and what the genre elements are to understand what the developers are going for. So that was just a lot of media studies writing and people saying, oh, this is what's in here and this is how you should look at it. And these are the components you need to reckon with. And this is a way you can analyze them, but also finding new ways to analyze it from suggestions from other authors.
Fantastic. Okay, so I think we've demonstrated that these projects can be creative, innovative, they can be really related to all kinds of scholarship, and they allow us to look at history and topics like community in new ways.
Innovative History uses the technology of LASER, Lou Ayer Student Radio, to record and edit the words you hear today. LASER is Pacific Lutheran University's student-run radio station. They play international jams and have laid-back sports talk. LASER works to represent the diverse music tastes of PLU in the greater local and global communities. Tune in and learn more at plu.edu/laser. LASR.
All right, so we all agree that video games are interesting and they have a lot of depth academically, but what are the real benefits of using video games as a way to learn history, particularly in the classroom? Fulton, let's start with you.
Well, first of all, basically, Coley, Jevin, and I, we're digital natives. I think for our generation, it's really important that we learn from stuff that we're around. So video games are something that are very interactive, and it's something that we all experience. Like, you know, we can talk about movies or music in the classroom historically sometimes, but video games are left out. I had a high school teacher who's like, no, we're not talking about Call of Duty. We're talking about, you know, D-Day from these photographs.
But the game does it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we'd all yell. And, you know, when we can interact with these pieces of history, I think the benefit is, like, you kind of get to be a part of that history and really feel related to it. It's kind of like a micro history, right, Jevin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just having that whole experience of being a part of it. It's not just text that you're reading in a book, which is separate from you and written by somebody that is thousands of years long gone. You're getting to be a part of it and actually experience it. You get all of these little details around you that don't happen when you just are reading black lines on a piece of paper. Like, you know, there'll just be somebody wandering around that's wearing historical garb, and you can say, hey, that might be what they wore during that time period, and just that whole immersive experience, I guess.
Coley, do you have another benefit of video games?
Yeah, I think that video games are wholly underestimated from the things you can just learn by playing any video game. We've talked a bit about problem solving and hand-eye coordination and all those different things, but I really want to touch on, like, reading skills, because a lot of these games come with books in them, especially if you're thinking about Skyrim has, like, 300 plus books that you can read if you really wanted to, including history books, I might add. Personally, when I was required to read in elementary and middle school, I would turn in my reading log and it'd be like, I read Final Fantasy for 20 minutes.
All right, so you had to show your teacher that you had read a certain amount of
A certain amount of time, right? And I turned on the closed captioning on my Final Fantasy game, and I said, I read it while I was playing it, right?
And so, how'd that go over?
You know, it was kind of an uphill battle at first, but I think I just eventually won by sheer force of will.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. It's just that I'm a little stubborn. It's okay.
Well, I do think there's something to be said for putting games in a context in which you also can, you know, use texts. You can also look at artwork, other types of materials. And so it's not like you're going to only use video games, but you can use them like you would use other different types of materials. And there's going to be a point of view from all these materials. And so students can recognize that pretty quickly, that this game leaves some things out. The game was designed as a commercial product, but it still can have some historical value. And we are looking down the road in this class and other places at the university, you know, for the time when games become a lot more immersive. And we hope that historians, yay, will be part of that group that helps design them and brings forward those historical issues that we would love to see talked about.
And we can see all these benefits of games, but there's also kind of some other things we have to contemplate. Accessibility, for one. I know you touched on that, Jevin.
Yeah, I wrote a lot about that in my paper, because there are, you know, so many communities of people that wouldn't even have access to video game console, let alone the actual video game itself. Internet access is another thing that we have to consider and keep in mind. And also just, like, time. People don't sometimes have time to play these games that can sometimes be, you know, 60-hour commitments. You know, Skyrim is, you mentioned Skyrim, Coley, is this huge game, and if you want to read this book, first you have to go and find the book in the world, which could take hours, and then you have to spend hours reading through the text on your TV screen, which is shrunken because you're trying to read a book on a TV screen, right?
It's fun.
Yeah.
So yeah, curriculum designers will have to recognize that not every student will have access to a console. Even if it's a handheld game, they may not have access to the software. And accessibility is really important for curriculum development. So that's really important. Fulton, do you have some downsides of games that you'd like to talk about? Like, what are some issues that we need to think about if we're gonna roll out games in our classes?
Well, I think accessibility, as we're saying, is a big one, but also, like, implementing them into the classroom, because they're very interactive spaces. And as Mike and I, Coley and Jevin, you're in that class too, the history and video games class, when I came in and presented Red Dead Redemption 2, you know, you can do whatever you want, basically, in an open-world third-person game. And, you know, people can call out things, or things will just happen in the game that you don't expect. So if you're going to play these games live, you might not have the intended, you know, consequence happen. So there's all these unintended things that can happen in video games.
True. True. Coley, what do you think? Some things to think about as we maybe try this technology in the class?
You mentioned the history and video games course that we all took. And I think one of the big ones is the idea of composite characters or composite events. So if you're not familiar with that term, it's essentially when multiple events or multiple characters are combined into one in order to make it more accessible. And that's not to say that that's necessarily a bad thing in terms of game design, because it makes the game playable. For example, in Assassin's Creed, you know, all these major figures surround the main character, right? That would not generally happen, where one person just knows all of these major historical figures and these events all happen to this one person, but that makes a more immersive gameplay experience, right? So we just have to be, if we're going to use it as a learning tool, we have to be cognizant of when events and people are collapsed together.
Yeah, the historians that use these techniques in a classroom really need to read some of the scholarship about teaching with video games. Thinking about Martin Wainwright's Virtual History, for example, yeah. Which many of you read. And that's a thoughtful book. There are others, Gamer Nation as well, that will kind of guide people through the way that you might use these systems to teach historiography and some of the history issues that kind of come up. You don't have to just walk in and start to play Call of Duty. You know, that's not the way it really works. So. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about that, Mike, and as a professor and an educator, how you approach that in the classroom?
Yeah, well, one of the challenges I had in the classroom was certainly I didn't know many of the games as well as many of the students did. I had played retro games, which I always talked about, right? I played those games and some of the early Half-Life games, but then I kind of fell out of the video game world and started doing other things, and then the mechanics were too hard for me to play very easy. So for me to just boot up Red Dead Redemption 2 and start playing was just challenging with the mechanics. So that meant that if I'm going to talk about these subjects, I have to find ways that I can do it with the students. And so you kind of remember probably, and this is an opportunity to kind of roast the teacher a little bit, but I remember, so there would be times that I wouldn't know as much as other people in the classroom did. And so how do you think a teacher should deal with that? Or kind of how did you help me kind of deal with that?
I can jump in. I think one of the things that you brought this up, this roast the professor, and all I could think of was the good things that you did. You made it feel like an environment where we were all learning together, including you. So we as the students have knowledge that you don't have, and so we're sharing that with you and kind of teaching you that in our own student, not professional way. Well, then you're also teaching us like actual knowledge about how things work and stuff, and we're just talking about our silly little game. So I really appreciated that as a student, that we all were learning together.
Yeah, I mean, just coming from like an education background, I mean, I literally just came from my class about this. humility is massive in terms of being an educator in general, and I mean, theoretically, or not, that's not the one that I want. You know, just giving people the whiteboard pen and allowing them to put their knowledge on the board is a huge, like, it's like a magic wand for a lot of, like, middle high school students. They want to, like, put their knowledge on the board. And so, as students in that class, yeah, you might not have played all the games that we played and didn't know what we were talking about, but the way that you utilized student expertise was really, really beneficial to the classroom environment and made it a learning community rather than someone at the front telling you how the youth should understand games.
Yeah, when they've put, you know, 300 hours into Skyrim.
reading all the books, yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of my schemes, though, was to bring in Fulton, right, who I said, well, he'll play Red Dead Redemption 2 at a certain time. Right?
Yep.
And we were talking about stereotypes of the Old West, which I knew from reading novels and other Westerns and things like that on TV, but then Fulton was able to play the games, and it was clear that I didn't always know, you know, what was happening.
Yeah, I remember when we went through it like a few days before, you're like, oh, can you do this, can you do that? Okay, yeah, I'll do my best here, but I'm not sure what's gonna happen in town. For instance, we went to the town of Valentine, a frontier town, and I forgot to do this horsemanship thing, and I was like, oh no, as I'm playing, but I can readapt this and reapply it elsewhere. So Video games, like I said, are pretty unpredictable. So
well, yeah, you said.
Had to pivot.
Yeah, you said. Now, when we go by the saloon, this one guy might want to come out and fight you.
Yeah.
And so he might want to beat you up, and I'm like, well, maybe we should just fight him. You know what happens? Yeah. Well, but if you do, it might get ugly, and it might be bad, and then, of course, there is the issue of violence that appears, and honestly, you need to think about trigger warnings and sensitivities, and so you want to kind of get the class ready, right?
Exactly. You have to really prepare for it. Both as a gamer, you know, like, okay, what's going to happen in this game, but also just knowing your audience and making sure everyone's on the same page and prepared for what's next. And we even got into a shootout, I remember that, at the end, which ended pretty poorly for me as the player.
Yeah, I mean, I just really wanted you to cut your hair, and everyone was yelling at you to rob the train, so I just...
I'll do both.
True, but then you just see certain people came to life during that session, right? They're all excited, and we get these course evaluations at the end of the term in which we can look at several months later, you know, some positive feedback or criticism, and many students said that was the best day when that guy came in and played.
That guy
came in. That was awesome. And he set up his gaming system. It's true. No one really said, dude, you don't know how to play games at all.
Yeah.
They people didn't say that. They tended to be. And, you know, you don't usually get there are many ways that you could criticize a professor. It's not just lack of games. We feel a lot of pressure about all the things we don't know. That's kind of the little hidden thing. Now, Coley, you're experiencing this now. You're in school in a graduate program to become a teacher. The two of you will eventually probably be teaching in some sense anyway. And it is stressful, right? Talk about that.
Oh, my goodness. You really don't know how much you don't know until you go up and someone asks you a question. And you're like, I really don't know that. I did a short lesson. It was like 20 minutes on Pride Parades and Stonewall. And I was like, oh, I'm so prepared for this. I spent 3 months researching this for my 301 research methods course, and I chose something that I know, and then someone asked me a question and I was like, I am frozen and I have no idea what's going on. So it's really interesting transitioning from being a learner to being an educator, because all those pauses where it's like, oh, we'll talk to your partner or do this such and such task, suddenly you're just standing there and like hoping that they do it. Like it's like, oh, I'm giving them 30 seconds, but are they doing it? And I haven't gotten to a point where I'm comfortable walking around and knowing if they've done it or not. But yeah, someone asked me a question and I was just like, you know what, I'll just get back to you later, because I actually have no idea, even though I researched this for 3 months. So
it is amazing, though, when you see people get excited and learn and say that this was a really great experience. So I'm convinced that this, despite the objections that you raise and the concerns and the concerns about the faculty who don't know it, and for those who are thinking about teaching, just you can hear from these students how kind they are, right? They're like, no, you just take, go for it. As Jevin said, establish a learning community where everyone's learning, and you just admit that you're learning along with people. They're not going to ask for a refund at the end of the day, you know. They'll actually be glad.
Yeah, I think one more like note that I would want to add is, like, if educators take away anything from this conversation, it's that the students like to watch video games being played. Videos are fun and cool, but there is that kind of disconnect of like, oh, I can just go on the internet and watch this and it'll happen the same way every time. But having Fulton come in and play the game and having things change, and, you know, he can be as prepared as he wants to be until, you know, Joe with the cowboy hat shows up and starts shooting him, you know, in the middle of class. It's fun to see that, but also learning at the same time. You're learning about how that worked.
Yeah, it's like you're learning how you respond as a gamer, and mm-hmm. like the mechanics of the game more so when you're thrust into these situations that you don't understand.
Okay, our next subject is the future of video games and how historians might collaborate with game developers. So let's imagine that the four of us are historians that do control the world in all the ways that we'd like, and we're going to kind of persuade video game developers to focus more on history, or at least use history as a tool within the games. Fulton, why don't you start us off here? How would you like to see games progress in the future?
Well, number one, I want historians to collaborate more with video game developers.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yep.
We see it in Assassin's Creed. We even kind of see it in Call of Duty, but often those experiences can be from one specialist in that field. For instance, Call of Duty, They used a their video game consultant was a retired colonel from the U.S. military, describing tactics about other nations that he didn't study or didn't really understand. He was fighting those people. So there's these kind of one-sided stories that they're approaching, and I think they just need to work with more diverse groups and develop a well-rounded viewpoint as best they can. And we know how hard that is as historians.
I also think historians need to understand, or people who are going to study history need to want to work with video game developers, just on the other side of that. I didn't imagine when I got my history degree that I could go on and be a consultant for a video game franchise, but that's something I could reasonably do for the subject areas I'm familiar with, or even just showing them historical processes and how the discipline looks at different historical events could be really beneficial to a lot of these video game companies.
Yeah, totally. I think it's the power of research and the power of going out and finding sources and really telling stories about the past.
So, Jevin, what do you think? What's the future for video games?
Well, my big future for video games concept is kind of redefining the word video game. I think the software that we have developed and worked on over these last several decades has the power to do some really amazing things, and it is doing some really amazing things. I know that there are companies that are implementing video game style virtual reality things into their filming. I know that some like nursing practices and other like that sort of doctoral work is implementing video games and simulations in video games. I think there's a lot of different ways that we could use this technology to enhance and teach us in ways that weren't before possible. If we were thinking about stuff like Microsoft Flight Simulator, right? Which is, it's not necessarily a game, but rather you're taking the seat of a pilot and you have to do all the different things that a pilot would do, or at least most of the things. I haven't actually played it. But things like that for other professions that could get us that experience without having to actually go out there and do the thing. I don't know if anyone else has thoughts about any of that.
I think you can definitely get some interesting simulators with like even construction simulators.
Mm-hmm.
Like historic construction of cathedrals or any sort of building from the past. It'd be cool to maybe be a bricklayer or, you know, work in the masonry.
One of the things that Fulton and I have discussed elsewhere is just we would love to see the game mechanics actually relate to a historical process or theme. Yes. So you're not just pressing the A button to scale a wall or something like that, which would be cool, but if you can actually do something that was done at the time, and if your motions in VR or augmented reality sort of relate to what a person might have done with their body in the past, then you are kind of recreating history or simulating history in kind of a new way.
Yeah, I think part of that's really cool is I'm thinking of Assassin's Creed, where there's so much detail put into these historical cities. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong because I haven't played the more recent ones, but I think in like Valhalla and Odyssey and things like that, you can just walk around through all the cities and just look at what they put into the game. And obviously we talked about like how computationally it'd be impossible to do in a one-to-one like depiction of the past to today, both for the reason that we don't have all the sources that would be necessary, but also because technology just isn't there. But imagine if that was in VR and you're in, like, you were playing Valhalla and you're just walking around through a city and you're able to climb a wall or something using your hands. Like, that'd be so cool and immersive, and it'd be like you were in there.
Yeah, I can talk about that a little bit more. The three most recent Assassin's Creed games, Origins, Odyssey, and Valhalla, have all later after their release had this like downloadable content mode called Discovery Tour, which is basically that you have an avatar, which I believe is the main protagonist of the game, but there's no like combat or like leveling or items that you collect. You're literally just walking around the world and watching people from or people that have been designed based on historical evidence going about their lives, and you'll occasionally run into like little nodes that you can interact with, and then a dialogue box will pop up and tell you like, hey, this person is doing this thing because of this, and here's our source for that. And I think there's, like you were saying, a lot of ways that, that could go forward into other different communities and periods of history.
What would you three like to see in the way of identity, in the way identity is expressed in games? Are there some new things that you'd like to see game developers do?
I think mainly it has to deal with the intent. There's this big split between indie games and AAA commercial video games and how they portray identity in different groups. There's that game Celeste, Coley, that you brought up earlier.
Yeah, I brought up Celeste mainly because it is really a story about overcoming like mental challenges and becoming one with yourself. So the main character, Madeline, is climbing Mount Celeste, essentially, and she's overcoming these parts of herself she can't accept. So there's actually a character in the game that's kind of her opposite, called Battlin, which is, they're the same person when they have to work together in order to make the goal at the end. But it talks a lot about mental health, and it positions this like very strong like female character, and it's an amazing game. And I just don't see a lot of that same representation in AAA titles. There's also kind of a little controversial bit in the community, because at the end Madeline is revealed to be a transgender woman, and the game developer didn't really make it a central part of the game. And I think that's fine. I think that we can have characters that hold identities that don't have to be central to plot. But it's just interesting to see how people interact with how different identities are portrayed within games.
And even AAA games are trying to do that and have done it. An example is Don't Nod's Tell Me Why from 2020, which deals with trans identities, but also indigenous identities and kind of socioeconomic experiences in small rural Alaskan communities. So it is something that's happening, but to the level and the extent is kind of different than what the intentions of an indie game developer might have.
Mm-hmm. Jevin, do you have a indie game that you wanted to chat about at all that relates to future trends or things you'd like to see?
Sure, I'll talk about Hades a little bit, which is kind of one of the biggest games that has come out in the last few years. It stars the protagonist Zagreus, who we all love and adore, but he has this identity that himself isn't like 100%. What is the term? I'm spacing on what the term is. Like, he's not just a straight white guy, you know. He has relationships with other men that are romantic or sexual, and sometimes he has relationships with men and women at the same time that are both romantic and sexual. And it's not this, like, they don't shove it down your throat, I guess is the way that I would put it. They have it in there as like, this is part of his character, but it's not his whole thing, which is kind of what Coley was talking about a little bit, of it just being there but not being the whole identity. I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
Well, I can tell you that Hades is a game that I personally cannot play. I'm really bad at it. But I really appreciate how flexible he is as a character. Mm-hmm. And I think they really they do a really good job at integrating different identities that the player can then play into or not play into, mm-hmm. without making it something that is so, I don't know how to describe this. So there's a lot of times in different sorts of media when somebody has an identity that is typically a marginalized group of folks, where the entire story is about the suffering or the trauma and then of that group, and then it becomes kind of a like a trauma showcase of like, this is the struggle that these people go through and we all need to like be empathetic about it. And there's nothing wrong with telling those stories. Those stories are important because people need to understand the reality of what it means to be queer, to be, you know, a person of color, to be indigenous. Those stories are really important, but it shouldn't be the only story that's told. And so I really appreciate that in Hades, Zagreus is not focused on in that way, if that makes sense.
It makes sense for me looking at you now, again, in a new light, as I always do. But, I mean, it's like you study the Holocaust, right? And
yeah.
You don't want to only study the role of Jews as victims, you know, in your work. You want to study the richness of all those cultures. You want to connect that a little bit for us?
Yeah, so Holocaust studies has been really influential in terms of the way I look at things. So there's kind of a saying that goes around, and excuse me if it's just trigger warning in advance, is the only interesting Jew is a dead Jew, which is something that Holocaust historians really, really push against. And so focusing on the resilience of the Jewish community, resistance efforts, the vibrancy after the Holocaust and the bounce back. And that's not to downplay the struggles that and the trauma that Jewish individuals and other victims of the Holocaust, like the Romani, the queer community in Germany, the disabled, all of those people experienced at the time. But it is to say that if you are in a traditionally marginalized group, whatever that group is for where you live, and all you see in history or in the media is trauma and suffering, what does that mean for you? So you really need to empower people through stories that show queer joy, that show people of color having a good time and, you know, not struggling in whatever aspect. Because yes, those struggles exist, and we shouldn't downplay those struggles, but that doesn't mean that there isn't joy to be found in people's life and their whole life is traumatic.
Yeah, I think with video games, you have the ability to see these ambivalent characters that can be seen in multiple ways. We could talk briefly about Laura Croft if you want. For those listening at home, you might have been waiting for the Laura Croft roundtable here at PLU and our discussion of video games. But how does a Laura Croft character kind of fit into this really ambivalent, you know, role model that we see in games? Is this going to go away, or are there going to do you have problems with the Laura Croft character? What do you think?
I think there's both problems and upsides to it. I can talk a little bit about the problems because it also happens with like male-identifying bodies, is that it just becomes kind of this typecasted character that doesn't change throughout an entire video game, an entire movie, an entire TV series. It stays static and kind of promotes an identity or some characteristics of who you should be that aren't so healthy.
Jevin, do you have any thoughts about this?
Yeah, I didn't experience the like older Tomb Raider games. I first played it when they kind of revamped the series in 2014, yeah. I think 2012, I around there. And I remember it being a fantastic game and just appreciating Lara Croft as a character and not necessarily as this objectified woman like some people in when the first games came out. I know that might have been a thing, and so just having her as this like human essentially and not as a woman to objectify.
Coley, what do you think about?
You know, personally, I love Lara Croft just because she's such a badass. Like she's just so powerful and I love her. I understand like she's very sexualized, very objectified, all of those things. And I mean, it's gotten better in recent games, but it definitely was really bad in the original Tomb Raider games. And I think it's fine to have, you know, a badass woman in a tank top and shorts, you know, like that's great, but it shouldn't be every woman is Lara Croft, because not every woman is Lara Croft. So I think that there's not a necessarily a problem with Lara Croft continuing as Lara Croft is, but there also should be other women, non-binary people, men who don't look like that idealized almost Romanesque form. Or, you know, if we're talking about modern beauty standards, the like bimboification like anime girlification, yeah. Of a lot of women in video games. I think that's definitely an issue. I think it's getting better, but you know, personally, I like Lara Croft, so maybe that makes me problematic.
Well, this is, you know, just another typical conversation about Lara Croft. We always have people on different sides of this issue. We're able to see how certainly students react to this material. This is the kind of a typical conversation I would say in a classroom. This is the kind of stuff we tend to talk about. The only thing I would add with this general topic about the future of video games is that we just need to recognize as historians that video games in the United States right now are hugely popular and lucrative. They are a economic juggernaut that is pushing media forward. They outsell all cinema and recorded music and streaming music and streaming video combined. So video games are this powerful sort of economic force in our society right now. So all these games are not going to be designed for historians or for people to learn history. All we would ask is that some of the games would start to think about more theoretical and thoughtful uses of history and historical characters and scenes and issues like identity and the environment and so on. And that's what this group is pushing for. So here at PLU, we're hoping to kind of push that study forward and really emphasize that in our work together.
Yeah, totally. And I think from that, you know, we can set out a little bit of what we learned. We talked a bit about our research projects from this last spring and what's in video games and how they can be used and what they do to the discipline of history. And with that, Mike, do you have one final question for us?
Well, I just want to thank our guests, because Fulton, you and I usually don't have guests. So
yeah, we're usually alone.
We want to thank Jevin and Coley. Thank you. How was it to be on the podcast?
Wonderful. Joyful. Awkward.
Just like life as a student. So yeah, perfect. But Jevin, thank you for being here as well. We really appreciated having you.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this. When Fulton texted me, this is one of the few like academic subjects that I'm really passionate about. And so getting to talk about that, not just to myself in the mirror, has been, you know, fantastic.
Yeah, honored to be on your respectable production, good sirs.
Well, and have us back.
We'll have to take the podcast on the road too, and you know, do some gaming and watch people play.
Innovative history tour.
Exactly. Yeah,
coming to you live in 2023.
Live at Comic Con.
Yeah. Live at VidCon.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Let's have one of them do it.
Oh yeah.
Innovative History is produced and recorded in association with the Pacific Lutheran University Innovation Studies Program in the Martin J. Neeb Center. All music written and recorded by Felix Halverson.
Technology and software were provided by PLU Instructional Technologies and Laser Lute Air Student Radio. Fulton served as the editor of the podcast.
Special thanks to Coley Query, Jevin Wilksy, Caitlin Williams, and the Department of History at PLU.